Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, you're probably aware that over the past decade or more, the weather seems to be getting more extreme. More powerful and longer-lasting hurricanes. Endless rain in some places while there's drought in others. More severe winters followed by record warm winters. And record early snowstorms and summertime temperatures lasting well into fall. What used to be considered 100-year events are now almost annual events. And along with those extremes come what might be thought of as the symptoms of those extremes. Ruined crops, destroyed homes and lives, damaged infrastructure, invasive insects, animal disease epidemics. It almost starts to sound biblical. And in particular, when we have dry weather and high winds in the West, we get widespread forest fires. Wildfires that go on for weeks and burn up millions of acres, along with homes and sometimes even entire towns. When several of these large wildfires are going at the same time, it taxes our ability to deal with them to the absolute limit. With us today is the Assistant Director of the Fire and Aviation Management Directorate of the U.S. Forest Service Southern Region. And that means he's the Fire and Aviation Operations Manager for about a quarter of the country. His name is David Martin. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being on with us, joining us from Atlanta here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by getting something out of the way. There's the still controversial issue of climate change. People used to use the term global warming more, but I think they've gotten away from that because the counter-argument often was, well, it's been real cold here this winter, so how can we be having global warming? And the answer, of course, is that worldwide, the average annual temperature is gradually increasing, and it doesn't increase all the time everywhere equally. But apart from the question of whether the climate is changing on a natural cycle or due to human influence or a combination of both, nearly every scientist in this field agrees that the climate is changing. And along with that comes the more extreme weather that I talked about in the lead-in. So does the Forest Service recognize a changing climate, Dave, and that there'll be more extreme weather events?
Well, the weather is certainly a major driving factor in wildfire, both occurrence and the fire behavior, how extreme they get. Combined with terrain and the fuel or vegetation conditions, they definitely hotter, drier conditions lead to, you know, more intense, more occurrence, and a lot of times longer lasting fire seasons.
So what kind of planning does the agency, the Forest Service, do to address that?
Well, each area of the country plans around, you know, anticipated fire seasons. You know, different times of year all around the nation are the prime time for occurrences. When the weather lines up, conditions line up, and basically there's a fire season going on somewhere all year round. But in the areas, in the specific areas where they're coming into fire season, you know, that's when their seasonal workforces are brought on. It's when try to have resources and personnel in place, any vendors or contract equipment, you know, kind of rotates around the traditional fire seasons. And as you mentioned, you know, with hotter and drier conditions and earlier starts of seasons and longer lasting seasons, you know, the agency's adjusted to that.
So it's not like you're running a manufacturing plant here. I mean, you're the manager of a very big chunk of the country as far as dealing with fires and the potential for fires. So when things are different than they were last year or different than you expect or different than the forecast is, how does that affect you? You talked about putting assets in place. I mean, how do you deal with the fact that things are constantly in flux and may change rapidly in unexpected ways?
Right. Well, we do our best with predictive services to get as accurate as possible on the outlook. But again, a lot of it is based on forecasting. So we do our best to, you know, have the right resources in the right place at the right time. But, you know, we're constantly adjusting that as occurrences and incidents come up. And we really, you know, no one unit has, you know, enough resources to handle extremely long extended attacks on fire. So we count on surge resources kind of boosting local personnel and fire managers and responders from areas that, say, aren't within fire season or aren't having the conditions that the areas of concern are having.
Yeah, so, you know, we hear about these long periods, especially in California and the far west, where there's like, you know, a dozen or more fires, big fires burning at once. And, you know, and these things seem to go on every year nowadays. So I'm wondering, Do you get increased funding and other assets that you need to meet the growing need, or does it kind of stay flat and you just have to scramble to do more with less?
Well, in the Forest Service, you know, that's been a real issue is funding suppression. We've recently undertaken kind of some new processes to anticipate it. It's slowly and steadily increased over the years, and you know, it's forced a shift of funds from, you know, other critical natural resource programs into suppression. But we've undertaken some changes in the management program and how we're funding the cost of wildfire suppression, because it can be overwhelming to an agency and impactful to the other programs.
Yeah, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that in recent years there have been more fires in the east than there have been historically. And you being the manager, assistant manager of the southern division, that includes a lot of the east, right? So has that kind of increase in big fires in eastern forests resulted in more assets being placed in your division as opposed to other divisions? Or is it still just a matter of trying to rely on other areas when you need it?
Well, it's cyclical, so we could try to chase right size and maybe wrong for the next season, because it's somewhat cyclical, again, as I mentioned, based on weather. So we certainly keep adequate staffing and resources and funding for, you know, what we would call initial attack for a standard response. But not only us in the southeast, but really everywhere in the country is dependent on that surge of resources. If they go into a lot of extended attacks, that would be suppression operations that, you know, go beyond, you know, one or two shifts, and those long-term fires, or if you get into a real campaign of one extended attack after another, then we definitely rely on bringing in resources from all over the nation if that occurs. And as far as, you know, my region, 13 southeastern states and Puerto Rico, like others, it can be very unpredictable. You know, we did have a pretty high visibility, busy fire season in 2016. A lot of activity, a lot of extended attack, and then we had a normal to below normal last couple of seasons. But now it's looking like the outlook is going to be a pretty active year, probably above normal in occurrences.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dave Martin, who is the Fire and Aviation Operations Manager for the U.S. Forest Service's southern region, which is 13 states, as he just said a minute ago. So, Dave, I know that all levels of government get involved in fighting fires, not just the Federal Fire Service, but also state and local agencies. And I guess complicating the whole picture is that across all these levels, agencies from many different jurisdictions might be working together at a given time. So who manages all of this so that it's not, you know, I guess, pure chaos, right? Is there a pre-established management structure for it that's kind of standard nationwide, or how does that work?
Yeah, I've always been real proud of the interagency nature of the Wildland Fire Service. You know, everywhere I've worked across the nation, different agencies come together, and we've done a very, very good job of standardizing things. Each area or region has a coordinating group, and within that coordinating group, there's different agencies, all of which have a certain amount of wildfire suppression responsibility. For example, my Southern Area Coordinating Group includes the National Park Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management. All 13 states are represented, and the Forest Service. And I serve as a representative on that coordinating group, and that's where a lot of you know, policy, procedure, you know, gets standardized. It also allows a great conduit for discussion whenever we're having to prioritize resource placement. You know, just because the Forest Service brings a heavy helicopter into an area, that doesn't mean it's just there for Forest Service wildfire response. We share resources. And each area across the country, each region, has the equivalent of that coordinating group. And nationally, there's a national multi-agency coordinating group, and they're typically stationed in Boise they're always established, but they aren't necessarily always all in the same room. But if things are busy nationally, several different geographic areas are active, then that NMAC, or National Multi-Agency Coordination Group, is always in place to ensure that good coordination is going on among the agencies. We have some very standard training for wildfire response. The National Wildfire Coordinating Group, or NWCG, which was established in 1976, has helped to standardize, you know, training, qualification standards. So a firefighter that works for the Georgia Forestry Commission might be in Northern California working for a National Park Service incident management team on a Bureau of Land Management land. And it's all blended very well when it comes to terminology and standards.
Sounds like a lot of conference calls.
That is a big chunk of my life.
So, you know, you talked earlier, Dave, about dry weather, you know, and it's obvious that the weather affects the conditions for fires to start, right? So when it's dry, the woods will burn more easily, and when there are storms, there's lightning accompanying them many times that can set a fire. But how does it affect the weather, affect the conditions kind of on a longer-term basis in terms of, you know, the overall fuel in the woods and the general condition of forests for being subject to the risk of burning?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly long-term droughts, high wind events, conditions like that affect our fuel moisture. Our fuels are categorized by not only by size, but by how long it takes for them to dry out, if you will, or recover from an event of precip. Rain, frost, or snow. So we've got, you know, categorized fuel by like 10-hour, 100-hour, 1,000-hour, 10,000-hour. And, of course, the long-term drought is a big impact on all of them. Certainly any kind of long-term weather conditions, extended periods of drought, or even the lack of a big adequate snowpack in western states is going to have a downstream effects, literally, on the conditions of the forest and other fuels.
I know that the Forest Service does controlled burns, you know, where you see that they're needed and where they'll be useful. But all of these things, I would assume, throw off your schedule for controlled burns, and sometimes you don't get to do them, and then that increases your risk later. I mean, how does that factor into it, just briefly?
Yeah, that's true. We have a very specific prescription when we're doing prescribed burning or controlled burns, and if the weather isn't exactly right, we can't get those done. And not only too dry, but too wet. We've got a narrow windows to conduct those burns, so we take advantage of all the times that we can, because that is one of our more effective tools in fire management, is reducing hazardous fuels under our terms, under the conditions we choose.
You know, there's something we see more and more with these big fires, which is, you know, million-dollar mansions being burned up. And I wonder, you know, just in general, it's kind of obvious that that there's a greater spread of homes into forested areas. People like to live, you know, on 5 acres in the beautiful woods rather than in a subdivision down in the valley or whatever. So is that a nationwide trend, and how does it complicate what you do?
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, we refer to that as a wildland and urban interface. And the Southeast particularly has nearly every national forest would be considered a wildland urban interface forest, but it's increased everywhere nationwide. And lots of initiatives underway now to really educate folks, you know, builders, homeowners, communities, on what they can do to better integrate with the wildland, you know, to have a fire adaptive community. You know, everything as simple as, you know, ensuring that you're keeping the vegetation cut back from your existing cabins or homes up against wildland, on up to being engaged in early community planning to ensure that they're being as adaptive as they can be, knowing that you know, fires are going to occur in the wildland.
Are there any kind of, you know, restrictions or regulations on these kinds of things anywhere, or do you just basically rely on people's common sense and a little bit of education that you can get to them to do the common sense thing, which is to keep the forest a little bit away from your from your cabin or whatever. Is it are there any rules, or is it just basically you're on your own with whatever you can decide to do that to protect yourself?
You know, that varies a lot from no policies or rules, only just good advice and education, to homeowners associations with very specific restrictions to include wildland fire considerations, building codes in some areas, community protection plans that include pretty clear direction on how to maintain your home to be defendable in a in a wildfire.
Yeah, things like cedar shingle roofs are not a good idea in a heavily forested area, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Something fire resistant.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dave Martin, who is the Fire and Aviation Operations Manager for the U.S. Forest Service in the southern region of the country. You know, a few years back, Dave, I had the supervisor of a firefighting group called Hotshots on the show. So tell us about the Hotshots.
Sure, yeah, I've got a special place in my heart for hotshot crews. That's where I started my career and worked on four different crews myself. But it's basically, it's a 20-person suppression crew that one unique thing about them is, you know, they stay together for the entire season. You know, a lot of suppression crews you see, they might have been just put together for that incident. But hotshot crews, you know, a bit more specialized in their equipment and their training, have, you know, higher fitness expectations, and they really do a lot of the toughest work on suppression operations. Their name was derived from, you know, when they were put in the hottest parts of the fire. So they're an interagency hotshot crew, which means a lot of the agencies I've already mentioned, you know, sponsor crews, some Forest Service, BLM, Park Service. And there's a total of 107 crews right now, and that's grown a lot in my career. And it's a pretty high operational tempo resource. You know, they are on the road a lot, typically a 14 to 21 day assignment when they are away from their base, and they're in high demand. One of the first resources that we end up not having enough of when we have a big campaign of large extended attack fires going.
Sounds like if it were the military, they would be special forces. It's kind of equivalent to that.
Yeah, I've heard that comparison a lot. Definitely a lot of camaraderie, a lot of pride in the crews, and definitely it's it's not a glamorous job. It's a job where you you'll know if you love it or not in just a shift or two.
There you go. Not for the faint of heart. There's another group called Smoke Jumpers that I guess are kind of like skydiving hotshots. Anyway, so you add a different element to it of diving into a fire. So why don't you tell us about Smoke Jumpers a little bit and how many of them there are?
Sure, yeah. They're aerial-delivered firefighters, parachute-delivered firefighters. There's 9 bases, operational bases across the country, but they can set up in a lot of different places as needed. Each base averages around 60 to 70 smoke jumpers, and they're similar to hot shots, you know, national resource and end up moving around a lot, you know, what they call boosting other areas, but very, very effective on initial attack. You know, they can be deployed quickly and across a big area. But very effective getting to those remote areas, jumping to fires, hitting them hard and keeping them small, keeping them from going to those large extended attack fires. And they're also pretty versatile in that they can transition to serving as overhead on fires if they end up on an incident that, you know, gets beyond initial attack. They'll oftentimes, you know, stay on and help manage or, at the very least, help size up and get the right resources into an incident.
Sounds like pretty skilled work, and it's obviously dangerous work. I mean, occasionally people get killed I remember when a large number of hotshots were killed in a fire in Arizona a few years back. And, well, you know, how many forest firefighters die in an average year, Dave?
Yeah, it's always tragic, even if it's one. But, yeah, you're right. It does have some risk involved. And certainly we establish a risk management process where we can, you know, identify and mitigate as much as we can. But it's risk management, not risk elimination. In a 10-year period, on average, there'll be 17 fatalities in wildland fire operations. And that's not just burnovers or entrapments. That includes, you know, vehicle accidents, medical issues. One of the hazards that we're always looking to mitigate and keep a heads up for is just falling trees or standing dead trees or snags.
Sure. Maybe even electrical sometimes. You know, I think that in addition to fighting fires, Forest Service assets now also get pulled in to deal with natural disasters of all kinds. That's kind of surprising to me. I learned that recently. And, you know, things like hurricane recovery and flooding and so on. So what are some examples of those kinds of things that your people get involved in outside of forests?
Sure. Yeah, all risk is kind of how we categorize the other responses that we support. And that's evolved a lot, even in my career. Hurricanes, floods. I served with the Madewan hotshots in 2001, and one of our first assignments was in support of the World Trade Center response. We were there supporting urban search and rescue teams. Also, the Shuttle Columbia recovery. You know, who better to grid through the forests in a recovery effort than wildland firefighters? That was discovered pretty quick. So lots of different things. Another one folks don't think about that we respond to are like insect infestations. A lot of times you end up fighting that like you do fire in forests, cutting breaks. So lots of different all risk assignments out there.
As if you didn't have enough to do.
Right.
Well, you're in charge of fire and aviation management, so the fire part is obvious, but what's the aviation part? Is it the air tankers that we see dropping water and chemicals on fires and maybe flying the smoke jumpers into the fires? I mean, what's that side of it like to you?
Yeah, that's right. There's a pretty large aspect of aviation and the Wildland Fire Service. Lots of helicopter flight hours and suppression operations, either in bucket work, you know, getting water on the fire, crew or cargo transport. Typically in a year, about 30% of civilian helicopter flight hours are in wildland fire suppression. And then, of course, the fixed wing side as well, extremely useful tools in delivering fire suppressant or retardant, as well as firefighters. And here in the Southeast, we're kind of divided up into operation planning and aviation. And there's a director equivalent at my level that covers the aviation side of things.
Are those assets, whether they're helicopters or fixed wing or whatever, do they belong to the Forest Service year round? And are they especially equipped in that kind of thing? Or do you charter some stuff on the run when you need it? Or how does that work?
It's a mix. There's some agency-owned aircraft, particularly on the fixed-wing side, but there's also quite a bit of vendors and contractors that, you know, provide that under contract annually. A majority of the agency rotor wing or helicopters, or I'm sorry, a majority of the helicopters are under contract. The Forest Service. The southern region here hosts really one of very few agency-owned rotor wing aircraft.
You know, there's a new term that I ran across in doing a little research for this show, pyroterrorism. You know, so fire terrorism. I've always thought of it as arson, like kids or some nutcase setting a fire for the thrill of it, but pyroterrorism gives it a more serious sound. Is that something that's happened yet, or what's your kind of posture toward that?
Well, it's certainly something... We've all had discussions about for some time. I can recall, particularly after 9/11, discussing that with my peers, the potential for that. We categorize fires now, typically either human caused or naturally occurring, generally lightning. But we certainly categorize arson, and that's broken down into lots of different categories. Not a politically motivated arson category being tracked by us right now, but it's certainly something that we've all had discussions about. The potential for pretty tragic events.
Yeah, I don't know what you do to protect about that other than coordinating with intelligence services. But anyway, it's like everything in our world today. there are new threats coming from every direction that you wouldn't have thought of 20 years ago. But
and this might not be relevant, but I recently reread a thesis by written by one of our fire directors on pyroterrorism that he had written when he was in the Marine Corps.
Well, you mentioned, Dave, that you'd been on 4 hotshot crews earlier in your career. So obviously you've got a lot of on-the-ground firefighting experience. Just give us very quickly, we just have a minute or so left here, but maybe just a thumbnail version of one that might have been particularly hair-raising or sticks in your mind more than others.
Yeah, I've had several near misses with some snags falling. That's always memorable. I tell you, one that I'll never forget is how close I came to a lightning strike. We were in Texas on a fire. I happened to be operating a dozer at that time, and came off of the dozer and was talking to the other responder that was leading me around the edge of the fire, and just within about 10 feet of us, and both of us saw it. It appeared like it started as they described, like a stream of thin smoke straight up from the ground, and there was enough time to sit there and look at it and think, well, where did that little fire come from?
Yeah.
And then just kaboom!
Wow!
That was definitely. I guess I've heard there's nothing more thrilling than being shot at and missed, and I definitely, felt that there. But, certainly I've been always been aware of the risk and the hazards to in the business, and take that very seriously. Being in the position I'm in now, we just want to make sure that we're sending our sons and daughters out to do the job with as safe a conditions, the best equipment, the best training, and just mitigate everything we can.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Dave, but, thank you on behalf of everybody listening. Thank you for everything you do and all your colleagues do, because you help protect all of us. So what's a good website that our listeners can go to learn more about forest firefighting?
A real good starting point with a lot of good links would be www.nwcg.gov, and that's the home port for that National Wildfire Coordinating Group that I'd mentioned earlier.
Well, Dave Martin, thank you so much for being on with us. It's been fascinating learning about the firefighting operations that you manage.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.